Verses 22 to 29 of Numbers chapter 20, wherever precisely in the text of Numbers we moved from the early days of Israel's sojourn in the wilderness after the disaster at Kadesh Barnea, we are now in chapter 20 near the end of the 40 years. Miriam's death was noted in verse 1. Now we have the more elaborate notice of the death of Aaron. The whole Israelite community set out from Kadesh and came to Mount Hor. No one is exactly sure where Mount Hor is. At Mount Hor, near the border of Edom, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Aaron will be gathered to his people. He will not enter the land I give the Israelites, because both of you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah." Now, the phrase "gathered to his people" is particularly important in this context. It is the usual way of describing the death of a righteous man at a ripe old age. It is the form of words used to describe the death of Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, and later Moses. In contrast to this way of speaking, it is a sign of God's curse not to be so gathered, a form of words we find, for example, in Jeremiah chapter 8, verse 2. The phrase certainly suggests that the person thus described will be reunited with others of his family, namely that real human life and real personal relationships will continue beyond the grave. Remember David's famous statement after the death of the baby that was the fruit of his adultery with Bathsheba, "I shall go to him." In ordinary usage in the Bible, being gathered to one's people takes place between one's death and one's burial. And that fact also indicates that it is a way of speaking of entrance into life after death, the afterlife. It used to be claimed, as some of you will be aware, that there was no doctrine of an afterlife in the Old Testament. Now that claim is much more rarely made, as advances both in the understanding of ancient Near Eastern religions and of the vocabulary of the Old Testament have made it impossible to believe that the Hebrews were the only people in the ancient world who did not have an expectation of life after death. I admit that the doctrine is not described in the Old Testament in the same detail, with the same clarity that we have it in the New Testament. That's true of most doctrines, but the difference isn't as great as has sometimes been supposed. We know that we can find in the Old Testament the expectation of a glorious life after death for the believer, but not for the unbeliever. We know that God's people will be vindicated after death, and that the Hebrews understood as well as anyone else that any serious concept of justice requires the hereafter, in which can take place the balancing of the scales. In any case, in this particular case, the death of Aaron, the phrase "gathered to his people" assures us that while Aaron and Moses eventually died in the wilderness on account of a moral failure, they were not excluded from the true and eternal promised land. The fact that Aaron was also complicit in the sin at Meribah when Moses struck the rock, of course, raises interesting questions about what happened there. Did the two brothers confer before taking action, or is Aaron guilty in some other way, more passive way? "Get Aaron and his son Eleazar and take them up Mount Hor. Remove Aaron's garments and put them on his son Eleazar, for Aaron will be gathered to his people. He will die there." In Aaron's case, of course, there was an office to be filled, and one that could be filled only by his son. The exchange of high priestly uniform indicates the transfer of authority from the dying high priest to the one who now assumes the office. Israel's life and Israel's blessing under God depended upon the ministrations of this office and the faithfulness of the man who held that office. So the transition from one high priest to another was a very significant moment in the life of the nation. Only this office was inherited, The office of prophet, for example, was not handed down from father to son. Interestingly, not entirely clearly, we read that the death of a high priest in Israel marked an epoch in the life of the nation, some sort of formal generational change. Someone, for example, who fled to a city of refuge because he had accidentally killed someone was required to remain there until the death of the high priest. Only then could he return to his family and his property. Eleazar was already a substantial figure in the Israelite priesthood as high priest-to-be, high priest-designate. We read of his oversight of the work of the Levites, or we read of it in Numbers 3:32, of his responsibility for the entire sanctuary in 4:16, and of his role in preparing the cleansing waters from the sacrifice of the red heifer in 19:3. In other words, he was already second in command in the Israelite priesthood and was well known to the people as Aaron's designated successor. Moses did as the Lord commanded. They went up Mount Hor in the sight of the whole community. Moses removed Aaron's garments and put them on his son Eleazar, and Aaron died there on the top of the mountain. Then Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain. As I said, the fact that Aaron climbed the mountain with the other two men leaves us wondering precisely how the death happened. Doesn't seem to be the case that Aaron was so frail that his death was imminent. Rather, the impression seems to be that it was the appointed time and the Lord took him, standing right there as he was between Moses, his brother, and Eleazar, his son. Or did the men, the two brothers and the son, sit down and have a conversation, say their farewells, perhaps a last prayer before Aaron breathed his last? According to Numbers 33, 38, and 39, Aaron died on the first day of the fifth month of the 40th year after Israel left Egypt and at the age of 123. That number fits with the note in Exodus 7:7 that Aaron was 83 years of age at the time of the Exodus. Now remember, these are lunar years, not solar years, and so will be somewhat shorter. Nevertheless, that 123 doesn't sound so unlikely after the death of that 120-year-old lifetime smoker in France a few years ago, you may remember. Aaron, of course, had spent most of his life eating leeks and garlic in Egypt. If that's the price you have to pay to live 123, it may make more appealing being gathered to your people at 70 years and 10. Finally, and when the whole community learned that Aaron had died, the entire house of Israel mourned for him 30 days. All Israel would have observed the three men ascending Mount Hor and would have observed Moses and Eleazar descending, with Eleazar now wearing his father's robes. The mystery and grandeur of Aaron's death, which anticipates the death of Moses and his burial by the Lord at the end of Deuteronomy, befits the death of Israel's first high priest and the founder of Israel's priesthood. Ordinarily, the dead were mourned for 7 days, so the 30 days was a sign of Aaron's importance and the dignity of his office. What a long and consequential life this man lived, though the last 40 years cast the first 80 into the shade. Aaron was the eldest son of Amram and Jochebed, 3 years older than his brother Moses, and both boys younger than their sister Miriam, who, as you remember, was old enough to care for the infant Moses. They grew up in Egypt. Aaron and Miriam, of course, grew up in their parents' home, knowing but presumably telling few others that their brother was growing up at court. What was it like for Aaron as a Hebrew in Egypt? Presumably, he lived his adult life as a slave of some sort. working for a master, his life not his own, unless Moses was able to exert some influence on behalf of his family. And then suddenly, 40 years after his brother had left Egypt in a rush, he was summoned by the Lord to meet Moses in the desert, and without hesitation, he obeyed. He was a man of parts, as they used to say. He had gifts. When Moses complained that he was not an eloquent speaker and was being sent to speak to others, the Lord appointed Aaron as his second. He is even referred to as Moses' prophet in Exodus 7:1. It seems that Aaron must have done much of the speaking to Pharaoh that is credited to Moses in the biblical narrative. When it says that Moses said to Pharaoh, in at least some, if not most, of the cases, it was actually Aaron who did the speaking, because he was a confident and able user of language. Undoubtedly, he spoke at least two languages fluently, Egyptian and Hebrew, in whatever form Hebrew had developed as a distinct Semitic tongue at that time. Aaron also worked miracles in the service of the Lord. He threw his staff down before Pharaoh and it became a snake. And it was Aaron who stretched his staff over the waters of Egypt and turned them into blood, and who did the same again to make the frogs appear and the same again the gnats. Before Pharaoh and throughout the period of the plagues, Moses and Aaron were a team. Pharaoh would summon the two of them together. Who would not wish to have overheard the conversations between those two brothers during those days? We next hear of Aaron when the Amalekites attacked Israel in the desert, and Aaron, together with Hur, held up Moses' hands in prayer so that Israel might prevail in battle. The narrative makes clear that the younger brother was the principal leader of Israel. At least once later on, that fact rankled Aaron. But in most cases, the narrative presents them as working in harmony and with a shared conviction. So much was Aaron Israel's second in command that when Moses was atop Mount Sinai for those 40 days with God, his older brother was interim leader of the nation. Aaron, along with his sons, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel, was given to see the glory of the Lord. Moses alone was permitted to draw near. The others had to worship from afar. Still, it was a signal privilege. But Aaron didn't have the same spiritual nerve and strength and fortitude that Moses had. He hadn't the strength of will, so yielded, probably reluctantly, but still he yielded when the people proposed constructing an idol, a golden calf, to worship. And this only 40 days after Aaron had beheld the glory of Yahweh. It seems clear that Aaron, at least, supposed he was worshiping Yahweh, and only Yahweh, by means of the idol, but it was idolatry nevertheless, and he should have known better, certainly. The entire episode reveals Aaron as less a leader than Moses, more easily influenced, with less courage of his convictions. Nevertheless, it was Aaron whom God chose to be the first high priest of the people of Israel, a wonderful reminder that the Lord is willing to use very imperfect instruments in accomplishing his will in the church and the world. What Paul said of himself, Aaron could certainly have said as well, "We hold this treasure in jars of clay." In that office of high priest, Aaron was the principal pastor or spiritual leader of the people, and as you remember, the only officer of the nation who could enter the most holy place. His great position makes it the more disappointing that on one occasion he and Miriam complained about Moses' still greater authority, a gaffe that ended with Miriam, a leper, having to be prayed for by her brother Moses. Later, the shoe was on the other foot as some elements among the people rebelled against both Moses and Aaron. There it was Aaron who made atonement for the people to deliver them from a plague the Lord had sent as punishment for their rebellion. To make Aaron's position as spiritual leader unmistakably clear to the people, his rod was placed among the others, each representing an Israelite tribe, and only his budded and blossomed and bore almonds. The priesthood he founded would last until A.D. 70, almost a millennium and a half. Do you know how few institutions there are in the history of mankind that have lasted or that last for 1,500 years? In all of this material, Aaron appears as living in the shadow of his younger brother Moses. Important as his role was, he was always second to Moses, and episodes in his life seem to demonstrate why. Even at the end, when he transgressed with Moses at the second Meribah, it appears that he simply went along with his younger brother's plan to strike the rock. He was too easily persuaded to do what was wrong. He was a man who had difficulty with peer pressure. He was not the intrepid believer, willing to stand firm by himself, as we have learned Moses to be. That may account for the fact that of the four sons born to him and his wife Elisheba, two of them, Nadab and Abihu, grew up to be, at least so it appears, young men with a rebellious streak. In their work as priests, they violated the regulations that had been so clearly laid down, and they were executed by the Lord for those violations. Still in all, Aaron was a faithful man. In some ways, his life was typical of the life of a believing man. Some splendid moments and some dismal ones. And that from the beginning to the end. We wonder what sort of husband he was, what sort of father, what sort of brother to Moses and Miriam, what sort of pastor. The Midrash, the Jewish commentaries on the Old Testament books that come from the time before and after Jesus, contain traditions about Aaron. The people loved Aaron because he strove to establish peace between the learned and the ignorant, among the learned and among the ignorant, and between man and wife. If he discovered that two men had fallen out, he hastened to first one, then to the other, saying to each, "My son, do you not know what the one you quarreled with is doing?" He beats his heart, rends his garments, and says, "Woe is me! How can I ever again face my friend against whom I have acted so?" Aaron would then speak to each separately until the former enemies mutually forgave each other, and as soon as they were again face to face, greeted each other as friends. In the tradition, it is also asserted that Aaron saved many marriages from rupture by his efforts, his personal dealings with husbands about their treatment of their wives. And that's why so many Israelite parents named their sons after him. Now, I don't know if any of that is true, but there is enough in the narrative to make it seem plausible that Aaron would have been a wise and discerning shepherd of souls. He's held up to us as an example of that in Hebrews chapter 5. Certainly, if he took seriously his work as one who represented the people in their sins to God, he should have had a gospel heart. The Bible is full of real people whose lives we know at least something about. The genealogies that we find so boring to read remind us that all of the history of redemption recorded in Holy Scripture took place amid the history of ordinary human beings. They were born, the delight of their parents. They grew up. They lived and they worked. They married and bore children. They grew old and then they died. And so it has continued from that time until this, the generations passing away one after another. For all of those 123 years, no doubt, Aaron felt as all have felt after him, that looking back upon it, his life seemed but a day. He could still see his mother's face when he was a child, still remember joys and sorrows felt as a young man, still feel the flush of young love, still remember what the world looked like long ago, as if it were yesterday. This is a fact of human experience. It all passes so quickly. It's all done so soon. So it was for Aaron. So it will be for every one of us. So mused I silently as over and over I turned the wrinkled pages lying round, the well-worn relics of long buried years, which rise to life again in every page, brief memories of love and grief and peace, with glimpses of still unforgotten scenes, faces and names of former days are here. I look out over this congregation and think I can still see the faces of some who were here when I arrived or who came early on in my years here, but who are with us no longer. Their lives were like Aaron's life in this. They had a beginning, they had an end. They had their ups and their downs. They had their successes and failures, but all along the way, they trusted in the Lord and sought to serve Him. And so we know from Holy Scripture, when they died, they were gathered to their people. I can see Elizabeth Love, the Tacoma businesswoman, unmarried all her life, daughter of a man who was first an elder at First Presbyterian Church and then a founding elder of this congregation. She was what is called a pillar of the church. She was an older woman when I first met her and became older and more frail as the years passed. A woman of intrepid faith, she had her ups and downs, her triumphs and tragedies, and like Aaron, when her years were finished, she was gathered to her people. I sat many times in her living room at the house on North Cushman Street listening to her tell the stories of her exodus from First Presbyterian Church in 1935, or the founding of this congregation in 1953. Or think of Ken Anderson, our beloved elder, or Frauke Boyle, most recently gone from us. I talked with both Ken and Frauke at length about their lives, their experiences, their trials, their disappointments, their satisfactions and joys. All of them said, as Aaron would have said after his 123 years, that it seemed as if it were yesterday. Yesterday when he was a boy in Egypt, or a slave in Egypt, or he was with his brother staring down Pharaoh those 40 years ago. Did the three men reminisce on their way up the mountain or at the top of the mountain? Tell some of their stories over again to Eleazar. Stories no doubt he had heard 100 times before. I have no recollection of my grandfather, who died when I was 2. His was an interesting and important life, a Presbyterian evangelist in the first half of the 20th century. My father had a life full of interest and excitement, ups and downs, but of course, I only saw myself some of that. My own memories of his life are from the middle to the end. I have a more complete set of memories of my sister's life. I can remember vividly times when we were together as children, in our teens, in college, and in adulthood. I can remember very clearly the days of her death and where and when I received the news that she had died in St. Louis that September night in 1996. What is a life? Here today, gone tomorrow. And yet a world of experiences, good and bad, a set of choices, all so important that they matter forever. For at the last, aware as we are of Aaron's faults, reminded even here as we are at his death, that he died when he did and where he did because of an inexcusable lapse in moral judgment, this man was a believer in God. For all his faults, he was a faithful servant of the Lord and a man whose death was a translation to a higher, more wonderful thing, from an earthly sanctuary to a heavenly one. At the last, here is the difference, and the only difference. Israel died in the wilderness for her unbelief, and she was never gathered to her people. Aaron died in the wilderness, but went from Mount Hor to Mount Zion. That is finally the story of his life. And the meaning of the entire story of his life from the beginning. The story of the pilgrimage of faith leading finally to the eternal country. Compared to that, nothing else really matters except the role he played in assisting others to live before the Lord so that at their deaths, which must come sooner or late, he or she would also be gathered to the people of God. What will it be like to die? And what will others, especially other Christians and serious Christians, what will others be able to say about our lives when we die? There are the great questions to put to anyone's life. I'm reminded of the death of C.S. Lewis, like Aaron, an eloquent, consequential man who lived an important life and who died peacefully, looking forward to seeing his Savior in the heavenly country, which he had so brilliantly written about in his Narnia stories. For Lewis, aware that he was terminally ill, his last days were days of climbing Mount Hor with his friends, days of reading the books he most loved, spending time with his closest friends, getting ready. No doubt he traversed his past life in memory many times over those few months, from his boyhood in Belfast, his dear mother who had died when he was a boy, his experiences, generally horrible in British public schools, the long march to faith in Jesus Christ, the books he wrote, his meeting Joy Gresham, their eventual marriage, and then love, and then her death. Several months before his death, you remember he died on the same day that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, Lewis had a heart attack and lapsed into a coma. As it happened, he came out of the coma and lived for a few months more, quietly and happily, by everyone's account. He wrote to his friend Arthur Greaves, "Though I am by no means unhappy, I can't help feeling it was rather a pity that I did revive in July. I mean, having been glided so painlessly up to the gate, it seems hard to have it shut in one's face and know that the whole process must someday be gone through again." Poor Lazarus. To another friend, he wrote, "I was unexpectedly revived from a long coma, and perhaps the almost continuous prayers of my friends did it, but it would have been a luxuriously easy passage, and one almost regrets having the door shut in one's face. When you die, look me up. It's all rather fun, solemn fun, isn't it?" Is that not here what we are encountering in the death of a believing man? The key to all of life. If death is gathering to one's people, if it is the entrance into the promised life and land, one's life and the story of one's life is one thing. If it is not, that life, whatever its story, is something else altogether. The ups and downs, the failures and successes, the joys and the sorrows, the short years or the long, all of it is compressed into this single question. Where does death lead? Where will my death lead me? It's this gathering to one's people that so beautifully encapsulates this point in our text this evening. The real burden of death is separation, isn't it? True, it can be very much the fear of what lies beyond, but for most people, that fear itself is heavily laden with the agony of separation from those we love. Our lives have been so inextricably intertwined with certain people, we cannot bear the thought that we must leave them and will have them no longer, torn away from them. Lewis again gives voice to this in a letter written near the end of his life. He tells Arthur Greaves that he's comfortable and cheerful, The only real snag, he says, is that it looks as if you and I shall never meet again in this life. This often saddens me very much. And you see the tears on Moses' face or Eleazar's as they descended the mountain after watching their brother and father die and performing the sacred rites of burial for him. But it's a sadness born of love. And to be overcome soon enough, as first Moses and then Eleazar themselves were gathered to their people, which is to say reunited with Aaron, now in the promised land, now unencumbered by the timidity and spiritual weakness that had undone him far too many times during the years of his pilgrimage. All that might be said of Aaron, to his credit and to his blame, is all of little account, really, if only it can be said he was gathered to his people. I may have told some of you before that not long ago I read a fine book by a Presbyterian Church in America pastor by the name of Ed Hartman. The book is entitled Homeward Bound, and I'd encourage you to get it and read it. It's a book about death and dying and family. It includes a great deal of practical wisdom on the subjects considered in the book from the Puritans. Ed Hartman was studying the Puritan doctrine of family and home at Westminster Seminary in California when he learned that his wife had been hospitalized back home in Mississippi with headaches that were causing her unbearable pain. It turned out to be a brain tumor, and she died shortly thereafter, a young wife and mother, leaving her husband with four children, aged 8, 6, 4, and 2. Ed Hartman tells us that in the last lucid conversation he had with his wife, Amy, 3 weeks before she died, he asked her, "Sweetheart, do you know what is happening to you?" She nodded her head slowly and replied, "I'm going home." He asked her how she felt about that. With quiet calm, she replied simply, "I'm okay. I know whom I'm going to see," and then she drifted off to sleep. Several months before she died, Amy had stopped by the local florist's shop on her way to visit a friend. She knew she was going to die, but she was not yet bedridden. While she was in the shop, she noticed several large floral arrangements that had been prepared for a funeral, scheduled later that day. Though the flowers were beautiful, she didn't like the pre-printed cards attached to the flower arrangements, with deepest sympathy, with our condolences, and so on. She said to the florist, "Those cards are too depressing, and I don't want any of those on the flowers you prepare for my funeral. Let me see what you've got." So she thumbed through all the florist's pre-printed cards and found one she liked and told the florist to put it on all the cards sent with flowers to her funeral. 3 months later, at her service, all the flowers at the church and the grave included the card she had selected: "Welcome to your new home." Aaron died in the wilderness, as we must. He was buried there, as we must be. But after he died and before he was buried, he was gathered to his people. So will be all those who have Aaron's faith. And his life went on. His wonderful life in his wonderful new home, happier than he had ever been before. That was not true of most of the Israelites who died in the wilderness, but it was true of Aaron. Two futures, two destinies of those who die in the wilderness of this world: to be gathered to one's people, or to enter the afterlife utterly alone. You remember C.S. Lewis's famous words, "There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, they are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals that we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors, or everlasting splendors. Consider the whole course of Aaron's life and then the whole course of yours. All the experiences, the ups and the downs, the failures and the triumphs. And then set beside all of that this single fact. You will exist forever in glory or in shame. Take that to heart. And then so live with the promised land in view that when you take off your robes and place them on your son, it will be perfectly clear to him that you are going to your people, and perfectly clear to you that he's coming after. Amen.